Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and this afternoon we are going to be honoring women who had just an incredible background, scholars that because of two modern day women are finally receiving the recognition that they should receive for their wonderful work. We're going to be talking with Nancy Parizo. Her book is called Their Own Frontier, Women Intellectuals Revisioning the American West. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Donna. How are you today?
Well, I'm absolutely fabulous, and I have to tell you, to go through the book that you and Shirley Leakey put together, maybe it's pronounced Leakey.
Yes,
you can correct me. I do not mind that at all if I mispronounce something. The work that you put into this and the information about these women that otherwise would probably not even be known for their tremendous contributions through their scholarly work, their dedication, and their efforts, and each and every one of them were just phenomenal, phenomenal people. Now, I would like for you to give us a little bit of information about Shirley and yourself. How did the two of you decide to come together on this project about 10 very, very special women? We're not going to be able to talk about all of them, but we'll get to a few of them. They're such profound individuals. Why did you decide you needed to do this?
Well, actually, it was an interesting project in that I had actually started working on this project in about 1982. At that time, I had done a project that was called Daughters of the Desert with another scholar, Barbara Babcock, that honored women anthropologists who worked in the American Southwest. And we did that as a very special project where we went out and interviewed women anthropologists who, if they had not done their work, I couldn't have done my work today. Mm-hmm. If they hadn't made sacrifices, if they hadn't talked to and worked with Native American groups, I couldn't have gone in and worked with the Navajo as I did on my dissertation. We interviewed people then, including Ruth Bunzel, who was 93 years old at the time. And we did this as an exhibit that traveled around the country for 3 years with the Smithsonian Institution.
Oh, my.
And it led to a book that I edited, which Shirley and I call Volume 1, called Hidden Scholars. And that was about just anthropologists. Then a few years later, and many projects in between, Gary Dunham, who was the director of the University of Nebraska Press, introduced Shirley and to me at a Western History Association. I was working on World Fairs at the time, which I still am too, and said, you know, you both have been talking about doing this, keeping going with Hidden Scholars, and Shirley and I got together. We hit it off. She's an absolutely fantastic woman and has turned into one of my best friends because of this project. And we sat down and said, let's compare historians to anthropologists. And let's compare their professionalization and the problems they face. And let's this time you do the whole American West, not just Arizona and New Mexico. And let's include Native scholars as well and what they were doing and focus on activism. So we started doing that, and we got together a bunch of incredible scholars to work on different chapters, and they were to assess the work of the woman in the area in which they were specialists today. So, for example, I used and worked on the life of a woman named Dorothea Layton, who I've long admired, because she was one of the founders of medical anthropology. And I had always thought that I had not done enough honor to her in earlier works I had done. So we felt that we needed to honor these women who made tremendous contributions to our knowledge about the American West.
Well, I think it is a tremendous accomplishment, and that is no exaggeration, because these are women who each and every one of them took a particular directive, and it was against anything that was socially acceptable at the time. And in your introduction in the book, you bring out a number of points, and I wanted to share them with my audience. Euro-American women, when they drew notice, played stereotyped roles such as the genteel civilizer or the oppressed drudge. Indian women were portrayed as beasts of burden,
right,
downtrodden squaws or princesses, and Hispanas or Mexicanas as fiery señoritas. Well, my goodness, that garbage still goes on today.
Absolutely.
I mean, you call it a bipolar portrayal, and I love that. I thought that was, those were two words, a bipolar portrayal. Very, very well stated. Here we are in what we consider a very modern world, yet it doesn't take much when you switch around the channels on your television to listen to the news and realize that in so many parts of the world, the woman still is looked down upon as an inferior species.
Yes.
And it is so aggravating to me. I sound a little irritated, I am.
That's all right, you should be.
I get so aggravated that this mythology, to me it's a stupid mythology that is being perpetuated by women and men of various cultures without respect to a brain doesn't care what gender's body it's occupying. If it's good, it's good. So why not respect it because it is good?
I agree with you.
And it is such a tough one. You had so many good points about anthropology, and you bring a point out about how it was not until really fairly recent times that anthropology took a professional status and women were to have absolutely nothing to do with it.
Are you thinking about anthropology? It changed at different periods.
Oh, yes, it's changed. Today, that's not the case.
Yeah. No, not at all.
Not at all.
But it's had a long and up and down history. One of the ironies about anthropology, when anthropology started, it's unlike history. It saw itself as a science. It was part of the natural sciences, okay? And natural sciences were distinctly, as a lot of the, as you'll can read a lot if you read into the women's literature and on the growth of professions in the United States, really tried to keep women out of professions.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because partly they were trying, when professions started in the 19th century, professions wanted to separate themselves from labor, okay? And housework is considered is labor. It doesn't have, isn't considered to have anything to do with the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And just like you were saying. But the irony is that of all the sciences, anthropology was always called at the beginning of the, end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, the welcoming science. Because it was noticed early on that if anthropology was going to go out and study and understand different cultures, different ways of life from our own, that you had to have access to women. And that men, when they'd go out, often didn't get any access to women. Because the women said, you're a man, we don't want to talk to you. So women, and especially in Native North America.
Oh, very much so.
The women would just look at these guys and say, why am I going to tell you women's knowledge? You're a guy and I don't even know you, you know, and
mm-hmm.
refuse to be passive research subjects, which is very fascinating. So anthropology quickly, some of them realized that you needed women to be data collectors. But you didn't need them to be professors, you didn't need them to be theoreticians, and you didn't need them to be the synthesizers of knowledge. Now, the irony of all that is that by 1930s, the two most well-known anthropologists in the world were Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict. And so there's always been this funny irony and funny late hate relationship with women in anthropology. And it got going, so women almost had a really good handle up and through the 1920s. And then when the Depression started, the bottom fell out again and kept going down during World War II. And it really wasn't until my group, actually, who went to graduate school in the 1970s, that you began to see some inroads. And with Shirley and me, we also made vows to ourselves that we would make sure that our students knew about their ancestresses, the people who dedicated their lives and given everything to make sure that women's voices were heard, and that the professions of history and anthropology had to have women's voices and had to have Native voices if they were going to be successful. But that it was a hard road, and it really all but destroyed some of the women, and it made others have very slow, long careers to get up to the points where men were.
Right, and Edward B. Taylor is a gentleman from Oxford University
mm-hmm.
who is a leader in saying you must have the women
yes.
in there. However, again, like you said, it was up and down, because I'm quoting from your book, "The Men Shaping the New Discipline commonly viewed women as poor material for conducting scientific research." They had the attitude, and I hear some of this still, it's not as much,
yes.
but still, men with their purportedly more objective, rational natures would control theory and grand synthesis, while women with their supposedly subjective, irrational, and emotional natures would conduct interviews and collect the necessary observational and material culture data for them.
Mm-hmm.
The women would serve as their helpmates and research assistants. Goodness gracious, we still have that stuff perpetuating society and most of the world in so many different levels. And I wonder if I will in my lifetime have the privilege of seeing some of that obliterated, but perhaps not, you know, human beings what they are. Let's talk about
yeah.
some of these women. And I thought, who am I going to choose? Because I know we, you know, don't have...
Favorite?
Let's talk about Anne Heloise. Who was this woman? The photos that you have in here of these women, some of them in Native costume, it's just wonderful. Who was Anne Heloise?
Anne Heloise? Anne Heloise was one of Shirley's choices. We chose different people in the book. But she was a very early historian. And she was a fascinating person because it's interesting that she's probably one of the few people in our whole book that very early on made it into the academy. And actually had a professorial job. She was an interesting person, and she was known in history today even as one of the most tenacious researchers. She was one of those people that had an obsession for detail, and she would not publish anything until she had triple and quadruple checked every single detail and document. And her work has really set a lot of the standards for historiography and for judging the quality of research in American history. And she was also one of the first people to look at American Indians and policy making with the federal government. Now, most history at that time was looking at, when she was doing it in the late 19th century and early 20th century, we're looking at things like the great men of history, okay, wars, and whose statue is in a rotunda in some state building, basically, for a better way of putting it, if I can. And the wars were always from the, I hate to say it, conquerors, but the white society's approach. And she actually was the first person to go in and look at Indian policy during the Civil War and how the Civil War in the United States actually affected how the different Indian groups were treated in this country.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the Navajos had their culture up in northern Arizona, and that's who I've done most of my research with. And they were doing fine during the Civil War, but because the Union wanted to make sure that the road to California stayed open so that California would not go with the Confederacy, they decided to get rid of all the Navajos and take them to basically a concentration camp at Fort Sumner.
Oh, boy.
And they weren't let out again until 1868 after the war. So she was actually the first person to start documenting those types of things, documenting how the different tribes in the Southeast decided whether to go with the Confederacy or not, because many of the tribes in the Southeast were also slaveholding themselves. And so she actually was one that started all sorts of schools of history in the United States. Now, of course, she didn't get credit for it, but that's another story as well, too. But she was tenacious in terms of that, and she became one of the first people and first professors at Smith College and became a role model for many people during the period up until she retired in the 1920s and that.
There's a statement in your book that she was not an apologist for national policy, nor did she see the spread of white settlement as a sign of progress.
Right.
She said we should have less of local patriotism, less of hypocrisy and complacency, and understand manifest destiny for what it most certainly was, the American type of imperialism. She definitely would have been unhappy with John Wayne's movies.
Oh, yes. And people like Frederick Turner, who controlled history, made sure that she didn't have an easy time in the profession, too,
mm-hmm.
because of those strong statements.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take after her until you get the new historians in the 1980s and 1990s before you get such strong people making statements like that again.
Mm-hmm. It's really a challenge to stand up to what is conventional thinking for whatever purpose it is established to be able to tell the truth. The legacy this woman has left is just amazing. Let's talk about Angie Debo and what she did. She, one, is an absolutely beautiful woman, but she lived to be quite an old lady and was so bright and perky. I mean, you've got a picture of her. She was in her 90s, I believe.
Yes.
When that was done, and she is... Her face maybe became wrinkled, but the vibrancy of her eyes and her determined chin is just amazing. And she's from Marshall, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
She was a pioneering scholar in Indian history. Tell us about her.
Yeah. Well, this is an individual who Shirley Leckie is a specialist in, and she's written a wonderful book about her, which is one of the problems with doing an edited volume is that, you know, our 20 pages don't do justice to people's lives in terms of that. But Angie Debo was a fascinating person from Oklahoma, and she was one of the people who have been recognized for her contributions. She has one of the people that began doing a special kind of history that it was really trailblazing. We talk in the introduction about that there is a field called ethnohistory today,
mm-hmm.
where you combine documents with going back and interviewing people, because all anthropology data is based on you go and ask people about things, and then you write it down. And so she was really one of the people that bridged some of the old Western schools and Western historians that had been heavily influenced by Frederick Jackson Turner and his frontier thesis and manifest destiny, like we were just talking about. And she was the person that set up for the new Western historians today who can look at this as conquest and what was happening. Debo specialized in Oklahoma and Indian territory, and she basically is considered the foremost historian of anybody at every time on the history of that area. And she is considered today, her works are all still in print. They're still just as fresh reading as when she wrote them. I still go to them when I'm doing a lecture on Oklahoma, since that's not my area of expertise, which I did today, in terms of trust relationships. But she also had an interesting career that was very typical of more of anthropologists than even some of the historians. Her trying to get into the academy and being pushed towards high school teaching for many years, and also then what happened to people during the Depression, as my mother used to tell me, and I'm sure yours did too, about what that was like and how you scrambled for livings, working in museums as a way to get into the field, and getting awards and getting years of awards and recognition for your work before you can get into the academy. But I think for me, actually, from the work I do in American Indian Studies, the most important thing is that she wrote her histories from the Indian's viewpoint. She would go out and talk to people, and she had the rare ability, especially at this time, to back off and say, what would it have been like to be a Choctaw at this period and at different periods and have all these Sooners come in and run over your land? And what would it be like? What would you do? How would you keep your cultures together? So in many ways, she was presaging what American Indian Studies specialists do today. And she was doing it 60 years before the rest of us had even thought about some of it.
Maria Sandoz. Now, I did an interview with someone regarding Marie Sandoz because I think she is just a phenomenal author. And she, her 50th anniversary edition of Crazy Horse, that's what I did the interview on, and you bring that up. It's her biography of the Lakota Patriot, and it was incredible reading, absolutely incredible reading. And she had such an association with the Lakotas and so many people. She actually knew them, and it was just amazing. And you chose her as one of your women, rightfully so, as far as I'm concerned. I was not familiar with many of the others, but with Marie I was. And this was an incredible individual.
Yes, and don't you think she was strong in terms of her life and the problems that she had growing up and depression? Isn't that phenomenal, what she was like?
Yeah, she's just an amazing woman. And the way she wove storytelling in, you know, the facts in a format of writing, it was just incredible. And here she is, the 50th anniversary, and her material is just as popular as it was. You also have Marjorie Ferguson Lambert.
Yes.
Now, this woman is amazing because she was able to integrate into the political arenas, social arenas, educational arenas. She was a dynamo. That's the only way I know how to describe her.
Well, having known her for my whole professional career, and she unfortunately just died a few weeks ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and we all miss her dearly. She was a phenomenon. I've never met anybody like her, and she was one of my role models. I always wanted, I said, when I'm 95 years old, I want to be like Marjorie Lambert, still still working and doing politics and making life better for people.
Absolutely. But, what a wonderful model to follow.
Oh, yes. She's just amazing. And luckily we were able to do several histories with her, and Shelby Tisdale, who wrote this chapter, and Shelby was one of my former students, and she's now director of the Museum of Indian Art and Anthropology at the Museum in New Mexico in Santa Fe. She's just finished a manuscript on Marge's life. So hopefully that will be going to a press in the next year or so. So again, people can read a wonderful story about this rich, fascinating life. And Marge Lambert, one of her best things was that she could do things behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
She had this ability to bring people together and make things happen. And she could do it even if she knew she was being paid less than the men.
Mm-hmm.
And she would do it anyway because she knew that things needed to be done. She pioneered a whole field of what's called historic anthropology before there was even a field on that. She was the first one to really pay attention to in the Southwest in terms of archaeology, in terms of Mexican and Hispanic period peoples that lived there. Because New Mexico is a multicultural place.
Yes,
and
it is.
She made sure that while she worked with Native American communities and helped them and was tremendously respected by them. In fact, at her funeral a little while ago, there were probably close to 400 or 500 Native Americans at her funeral.
Now that's quite a statement by the Native Americans.
Yes,
of respect.
It was. And it was, I sat there and cried, but they did honoring songs for her, for hours and went into the night in terms of that. And they considered her what, Helen, Cordero once told me, that Marjorie Lambert was one of those people who was born to be an ally, to help people, protect their history and their cultural resources, to make sure it got back to that and so their story could be told.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The information you have about these various women, what they were able to accomplish despite the attitudes of their generation, their history,
mm-hmm.
and as you have so eloquently stated, you have had wonderful role models that as of the 80s and 90s, then the shifts that enabled women to become more participatory in this type of environment was more acceptable. And look at what you've been able to do, and you have been able to bring forth, you and Shirley have been able to bring forth this wonderful book, Their Own Frontier, Women Intellectuals Revisioning the American West. You've been able to bring forth truth regarding each of these women, their contributions, and how it has had such a phenomenal impact on how we do things today. Their standards were high. They had not just expectations of themselves, but of others, and they worked against incredible odds. What would you, Nancy, say to a young woman today, or even a student, that might have a passion for learning and being aware of history and being involved in anthropology? What would you tell them that they need to know, that they need to recognize about the opportunities that would be in front of them?
So you'd like to know the things I tell them every day, okay?
All right, let's do it.
Since I have them every day, one of the things I would tell them about is that one of the things they need to do and that all these women did was that they had to be good observers of organizations and institutions and know their own history so that they can understand where the barriers to their careers might be and where the challenges will be and then where the opportunities are coming. And so, for example, one of the things I do, and for example, I used to get told in graduate school that I was smart for a woman. I made a vow when I finished, and Shirley made a like vow, which was one of the reasons we became good friends, that we never wanted to hear that again. that somebody was smart for a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I do the same thing now, and I don't want to ever hear somebody tell me that an American Indian is smart for being an Indian either,
mm-hmm.
or African American, or someone from Africa. It's just like you were mentioning at the beginning of the show. So one of the things I would tell them is to read and understand about what their ancestresses went through, but to look at all these women and see how they found niches that they could become experts in and they could set the standards for. I would also teach them today some better methods to become a little well known in terms of that. But people like Alice Marriott, for example, told me that when she got through with her career, started her career, she went to work for the federal government, even though she was thinking of going back to school. Now we're in an we're coming into an economic time which is going to be like the depression
mm-hmm.
again for academia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when I graduated in 1981, the employment rate for new PhDs was down to 1932 levels. And we're just starting back into that. So one of the things I show people is how to take their knowledge, of, and especially anthropology, because anthropology is a way of life, okay? You have certain ethical values with it. And that you can help do certain kinds of research in a number of ways, and you can make different contributions in a number of ways. For example, one of the best ways at the moment for people to do is that they can work on, and I've just talked to a student this morning about this, she can go into film documentary research and have some of her work up on the web and will reach more young potential scholars than I will teaching a class to 40 people in the university.
I'm going to have to stop you, Nancy, because we've got to take a break.
Okay.
But I want you to know that this has been absolutely a delight. I am so thrilled that we were able to connect. Your book, Their Own Frontier, Women Intellectuals and Revisioning the American West, is outstanding. You and Shirley, Lucky, have done such a wonderful job. And for those of you listening, if you'd like to find out more about it, go to nebraskapress.unl.edu. That's nebraskapress.unl.edu. Nancy, thank you again for being my guest today.
Well, thank you, Donna. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too, dear. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away. More good things to share.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to DTaP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
SIBO. By the way, my guest, Nancy Parizo, she made a statement when we were off the air because we had to take a break. She made a statement. She said, women need to creatively be outside of the box. If you want to make a place in life, you need to do that. But I want to say it's for both men and women. You know, we are living in a world today that is demanding change. Much of what would be considered the old way of doing things, because of whatever reason, going green, it's just we need to shift. We need to have a stronger sense of responsibility on multiple levels and expand into arenas of thinking and development, manufacturing, so many other things. We need to be able to make that shift. So thinking outside of the box is for all of us on so many different levels. So I wanted to share that with you. Also, I want to let you know, telephone lines are open. That's right. If you want to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. So here are the toll-free telephone numbers you can call into. They're open now. 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. We also have a direct line that's available to you, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. If this is your first time with the Donna Sebo Show, I'm so delighted you have found us and you're able to join us. And we're on every day of the week, and we just really look forward to having you share what we are able to bring to you. And just know that you are not only welcome, but if you want to call in and chat with me, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. And, of course, I love to know what part of the country you're calling in from. And then after that, let me tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that is significant to you. I want to take this opportunity also to thank those of you that are sending me wonderful emails, wonderful stories, which I'm going to share with you. I had a woman by the name of Carol who has sent me this great story. I don't know who originated it, nor does she, but she sent it along to me, and there's so many wonderful things that you are contributing, and I just want you to know how much I appreciate it. And all you need to do, if you have something special to send me, is to contact me at Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at DelphiInternational.com, and when I'm in a position to do so, I probably will be using your material. I got this email from Carol, and someone else had shared it with me, and then I found one in my email box, and I said, okay, this is so good. I really want to share it, and it's a true story, but I don't have the individual's name, so bear with it. And again, Carol, I want to thank you. It's called The Sack Lunches, and this is how it reads. I put my carry-on in the luggage compartment and sat down in my assigned seat. It was going to be a long flight. I thought, I'm glad I've got a good book to read. Perhaps I'll even be able to get a short nap. Just before the plane took off, a line of soldiers came down the aisle and filled all of the vacant seats, totally surrounding me. I decided I'd start a conversation with them, and I asked one soldier who was sitting nearest to me, where are you headed? His response was, to Chicago, to Great Lakes Base. We'll be there for 2 weeks for special training, and then we're being deployed to Iraq. After we had been flying for about an hour, an announcement was made that sack lunches were available for $5. It would be quite a few hours before we were going to reach Chicago, and I decided rather quickly that a lunch would help pass the time. I started reaching for my wallet, and as I was doing so, I overheard a soldier ask his buddy if he planned to buy some lunch. This was his response. Nope, that seems like a lot of money for just a sack lunch. Probably wouldn't be worth $5. I'll wait till we get to Chicago. His friend agreed with him. I looked around at the other soldiers around me. None were buying lunch. So I got up out of my seat and walked to the back of the plane and got the attention of one of the flight attendants and gave her a $50 bill. This is what I said. Take a lunch to all the soldiers. The flight attendant grabbed my arms and squeezed tightly. Her eyes were wet with tears and she thanked me. My son was a soldier in Iraq. It's almost like you're doing it for him. She picked up 10 sacks for lunch and headed up the aisle to where all the boys were seated, the young soldiers. She stopped at my seat after I went back and sat down and asked me, which do you like best, beef or chicken? I looked at her a little perplexed. I said, chicken. I couldn't figure out why she'd ask. The attendant turned and went to the front of the plane, returning a minute later with a dinner plate from first class. This is your thanks, she said. After we finished eating, I went again to the back of the plane, heading for the restroom. En route, a man stopped me. He looked at me and said, I saw what you did. I want to be a part of it. Here, take this. And he handed me $25. Soon after I returned to my seat, I saw the flight captain coming down the aisle looking at the aisle numbers as he walked. I hoped he wasn't looking for me, but noticed he was looking at the numbers only on my side of the plane. When he got to my row, he stopped, smiled, held out his hand, and said, I want to shake your hand. Quickly unfastening my seatbelt, I stood and took his hand. With a booming voice, he said, I was a soldier, and I also was a military pilot. There was a day when someone bought me a lunch. It was an act of kindness I never forgot. I have to tell you, I was a little embarrassed when applause was heard from all of the passengers. Later on, I walked to the front of the plane so I could just stretch my legs. A man who was seated about 6 rows in front of me reached out his hand, wanting to shake mine. He left another $25 in my palm. We landed in Chicago, I gathered my belongings, and, like everyone else, started to deplane. Waiting just inside the airplane door was a man who stopped me, put something in my shirt pocket, turned and walked away without saying one word. I discovered it was another $25. Soon entering the terminal, I saw the soldiers gathering for their trip to the base. I walked over to them and handed them $75. I said, it'll take you some time to reach the base. It'll be about time for a sandwich. God bless you. 10 young men left that flight feeling the love and respect of their fellow travelers. As I walked briskly to my car, I whispered a prayer for their safe return. These soldiers were giving their all for our country. I could only give them a couple of meals. It didn't seem very much. A veteran is someone who, at one point in his life, wrote a blank check made payable to the United States of America for an amount of up to and including my life. That is honor, and there are way too many people in this country who no longer understand it. Author unknown. Carol, I think the story is fabulous. Thank you very much for sending it. I'm so pleased I was able to share it with my audience. Donna Sebo, right here, right now, give me a buzz if you'd like for me to give you some intuitive insight. Telephone number 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756, and 530-876-3222. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a minute. Oh, have that pad of paper and pen handy. I have a recipe for you. You'll find out more when we come back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedros. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756, and also 530-876-3222. Let me share with you who we've got next week for guests. We're going to be talking with Dr. Susan Silverstein. We're going to be talking about health, hungry for health, and also a breast cancer kit. So we're covering dietary wellness, and also what you need to be aware of as a woman if you want to be alert to maybe a condition such as breast cancer. Also, we're going to be talking about the Freedom Formula, Christine Crosser. That's on Tuesday. The Book of the Bazaar, Vala Ventura, lots of fun stuff. Hey, Halloween is next week. It's going to be fun. Then we're also going to be talking to Cynthia O'Neill. The book is an unusual one. It's Our Energetic Evolution in Healing. So this is a topic that there are so many different paradigms on, and we're going to be exploring one. Now, it's going to be an open mic day on the 31st, but we may have a surprise for you that I know you will enjoy. It's all about Halloween. I won't tell you any more until I get absolute confirmation about this very, very special happening that's going to occur on Halloween. Yes. Oh, I just love the holiday. It's one of my favorites. Okay. Again, give me a buzz if you want to chat. 877-8765-227, 888-815-9756. Do you want to do something for your yard? And maybe you don't have one, but here in the Pacific Northwest, everything is coming off the trees. This is the time of the year when we get storms coming in all of a sudden. The winds will just tear the leaves that have turned these beautiful vermilion, yellows, I mean, just all kinds of colors. Well, do you know that those leaves can really make a wonderful, wonderful mulch? And if you have a supersized composter, if you live in an area like we do where you have so many deciduous trees, you have blankets of leaves and pine needles and other stuff that just stack up. And so you wonder, gee whiz, maybe I should clean everything up. However, you don't necessarily need to do that. Here are three tips that are very, very good if you want to take what's free from your trees and transform it into something that's going to benefit your yard, your lawn, your plants, everything. Free fertilizer. Leaves can be turned into a nutrient-rich soil conditioner by composting them in a quick, easy way. All you need to do is poke dime-sized drainage holes into heavy-duty garbage bags, stuff them full of the leaves, and leave them alone. Just stack them. By spring, you'll have a free, all-natural way to be able to fertilize your own garden. Also, there's a suggestion by many ecologists. Don't rake. Instead, a few passes over the fallen foliage with a mower will shred the leaves into tiny, near-invisible bits, and then just leave them where they lie. There's been studies done at Purdue University where they found when you do this, it's going to make your lawn healthier and better able to weather dry spells, insects, and disease in the new year. And if you want to get a head start in your spring garden, well, instead of, saving yourself the backbreaking work of digging a brand new flower or vegetable bed, rake a 3-inch layer of leaves onto the site. During the winter, the thick, heavy pile will kill the grass, leaving you with a clear spot, clean spot, to sow your new seeds. So just a few tips there to pass along to you. Okay, I said I had a recipe. Yes. If you're like me, one of your favorite meats is chicken. And chicken can be fixed in so many different ways, but our favorite is stuffed chicken parmesan. Yes, so this is really good, and I wanted to be sure that I got this off to you today. So remember, if you miss it, you can always use the archives and get it again. Now, this is what you're going to need. This is 2/3 of a cup of part skim ricotta cheese, 2/3 of a cup of ricotta cheese, 4 tablespoons of chopped fresh parsley. If you don't have fresh, you can use the dried. 3 tablespoons store-bought prepared pesto. If you don't like store-bought, use your own. Then 2 tablespoons of grated Parmesan cheese, 6 boneless, skinless chicken breast halves, which is about 2¾ pounds of meat. You're going to need some wooden toothpicks. You'll need 1 egg. Remember, that egg should be at room temperature. You need 3/4 of a cup of Italian seasoned dry bread crumbs. Or you can just take ordinary dry bread crumbs and add your own seasoning. A jar of sun-dried tomato marinara sauce. That's about 26 ounces worth. A can of petite diced tomatoes. You're going to need about 12 ounces of spaghetti. And 8 ounces of fresh mozzarella cheese. You want to cut it into 8 slices. And you can have some basil, if you like, some fresh basil sprigs, optional. Now, this is going to serve about 6 people. What you want to do is preheat your oven to 400 degrees, and you want to have something like a jelly roll pan, and you want to spray it with cooking spray. Now, in a bowl, you're going to combine your ricotta, your 3 tablespoons of parsley, fresh or dried, pesto, and Parmesan. You want to mix that all together. You want to put that mixture into a plastic food storage bag, and you want to clip a hole in one corner of that bag and just set it to the side. You then are going to take each chicken breast and cut a 2-inch deep horizontal pocket. You want to then pipe your ricotta mixture into the pockets, and then you want to secure it with toothpicks. Then, in another bowl, you have your egg, a shallow bowl. You slightly beat it. You put your breadcrumbs on wax paper. You dip your chicken into the egg and then coat in the breadcrumbs. Put it on the pan. Just put a little bit of oil. You can use your cooking spray if you want. A little bit of oil on the chicken. And then bake your chicken in a 400 degree oven until it's no longer pink. It's going to take about 20 minutes. Now, while that's happening, in a pot over medium heat, you're going to combine your marinara sauce and the tomatoes. You cover it, bring it to a boil, reduce the heat then to low, and just let it simmer for 15 minutes. The pasta you cook according to the package directions, and you drain it. So what you then want to do is your chicken, which has been cooking for about 20 minutes, you want to put 1½ cups of your sauce over the chicken. Then put your mozzarella on top, and you bake it until the cheese has melted, which is going to be about 3 minutes. Then your pasta, you mix with the remaining sauce after it has been well drained. And then before serving, of course, you're going to remove the toothpicks from the chicken, serve it with the pasta, and then sprinkle with your remaining parsley and maybe a little bit of fresh basil. A delicious dish, very flavorful. And if you want to, like I do, improvise, then add a little bit of garlic here, or just use your imagination. But this is a dish that is going to be so moist, so wonderful, and it will just be absolutely enjoyed by everyone. That's one of the things about the cooler temperatures. You can have these flavorful fragrances of sauces that fill the house, and everybody comes in and they go, wow, that smells good, just like a good soup. So that's the recipe I wanted to share with you today. I thought you would enjoy it. Stuffed chicken parmesan. Good stuff. The Italians, they know how to make it good. They really do. I came from a household like that, and it was just absolutely wonderful to enjoy good food. Okay, if you want to save some money on gas, keep in mind, and this is sort of a frivolous comment, but keep in mind, if you're going to a fast food restaurant, don't put your car in one of those long lines, for heaven's sakes. You're going to be wasting more gas than not. Park your car walk in. One, you'll get exercise. And two, you're probably going to be served faster when you're on the inside. Have you ever noticed people complaining about the gas prices? And then they go and they put themselves in situations where they're leaving their engines on for the longest time, and they're just idly burning up a lot of gasoline. Don't be one of those people. Hey, this is Donna Siebel. We've run out of time. My goodness, you're going to have a fabulous weekend ahead of you. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Trust and believe in what you're able to understand. Be willing to explore. Just like the people we were talking about earlier on the show today. Women who dared to step outside of the box of their environment. Men and women both. You need to remember that this is your opportunity right here, right now, to find your direction, to be able to perhaps do something that's going to leave a legacy that is make a difference in the lives of others. Go for it. If you don't do it now, when are you going to do it? This is Donna Siebel. Have a fabulous weekend. Be safe, and we'll see you back here on BBSRadio.com, same time, same place, on Monday. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.